last Sunday morning, 1 a.m., I found myself teetering precariously on a 3-foot ledge at the base of a column, some 25 feet from the altar which surrounds the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. I was trying as best I could to avoid being crushed in the movement and the mass of the worshipers who had come for Easter services. The last Sunday was Easter morning, according to the calendar of the Eastern Christian Church. And I was concerned a little bit for my safety, but more, I confess, for my clothing, because this is the fire service. A new light is lit on the altar. The light of renewal has been reborn. Christ has been resurrected. And this light is taken out from the altar by the officiating priest and carried by him and his acolytes around the church. And each of the worshipers lights his own taper from the holy fire. And frankly, the whole thing seems a little bit to this Westerner to be somewhat dangerous. They're a little shorter than I am, most of the worshipers. And I found that there were any number of tapers right at my shoulder height. Discretion, height, seemed the better part of valor. Now, what was a rabbi doing at Easter morning services at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre? Well, I was doing what rabbis are supposed to do. I was tending my flock. In this case, I was shepherding three of the fine clerical colleagues in Cleveland for a visit to Israel. John Burt, the Episcopal Bishop of the Diocese of Ohio; William Cosgrove, the Auxiliary Bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Cleveland; Al Pennybacker, the minister of the Heights Christian Church, who was very active in his Disciples of Christ Protestant denomination. You know, the word ecumenical is one I can't spell, but it's a very popular word among my Christian colleagues. It has to do with the drawing together of the disparate groups within Christendom. And they're very filled with ecumenical spirit. They must be, to go out at 1 o'clock in the morning. And they were drawn to see how Easter was celebrated in this holy of holy places in Christendom by those whose rites are so very different from those which these men were familiar with in the West. And I'm a human being, which means I'm curious. I went along to see what happens. And I found there interesting something which was both very old and very new. A service which fits the prescription which any number of our young people, the advocates of Consciousness 3, tell me we ought to be celebrating today. There are no pews in this small church. There are no prayer books. It's a procession. It moves around from place to place. The officiants have a set routine, a ritual which they follow. There's a very beautiful chant which is sung out by the male chorus voice, which moves along with the procession. The devout crowd about move here and there. Some participate in the service, some simply stand around. All of it has movement, spontaneity, enthusiasm. All of it is, to use the modern jargon term, very real, very genuine. And I saw in this service great piety and great irrelevance, all the pros and the cons of any worship service. It convinced me that there's much to being moved to being without pews, without prayer books, spontaneous. And it convinced me that there's a great deal to having pews and having a prayer book and having a tradition. The melodies that I heard that night were very similar to the minor keyed, male-voiced melodies which are familiar to all of us from Chazanut, from the cantorial chant of the Eastern European synagogue. In fact, the chant of the Eastern Orthodox Church and the chant of the synagogue come from a similar root in the Gregorian chants of the church. The movement, the processional, you've seen before. You see it in the traditional synagogue on Simchas Torah, when the scrolls are taken out of the ark and processed around the bima, around the central altar. In this case, in this Greek Orthodox Easter morning service, they took the holy fire and they took it in procession three times around the sepulcher. And the officiating patriarch, the Greek Orthodox patriarch, blessed the assembled mob by moving in the cruciform fashion, an icon medallion, and everyone felt renewed, encouraged, blessed. At Hakafot time, when the Torah scrolls are processed three times around the altar of the synagogue, the kiss of God is given in a different kind of way, but it's nonetheless real. There's the motion and the processional. But this time the worshiper takes his talit, his prayer shawl, and he touches it to the Torah mantle and then touches it to his lips, as if to kiss God, his faith, his convictions in that way. I saw that night an elderly woman sitting just below me, her eyes closed. She was mumbling the worship, the chant right along with the choir. She was transported in pure piety. And behind her on one of the stairs in this small church, I saw a couple of young adolescents holding hands, petting one another. This was obviously just a great holiday for them. And above the sepulcher, there was a balcony. And between the balcony, they had thrown a plank. And on the plank, seated cross-legged, was a Greek Orthodox priest with flash gun and camera in hand, wigwagging signals down to the celebrants to make sure that they were properly postured so he'd get good pictures for his album. It had everything in it. Everyone left this service satisfied. It had been at the right place, the right movement, the right time. But no one, I suspect, left this place inspired, having been given new insight. For no word was spoken. No, there was no sermon. There was no one who said, look, next year has to be different than this year. It isn't enough to endure and to survive. It isn't enough to be blessed by God for another year like the past. Get some new insight, this insight, God's insight, into your lives. This was pageant and procession and piety. It wasn't the living word and instruction and insight. It was very different, very much the same. And it was interesting in many ways. We came, all of us, strange, even these fine Christian scholars, strange to this Eastern Orthodox, Greek Orthodox service. We carried in our hands, interestingly, a book, a rather thick book, which describes all of the rituals and all of the rites of all of the many Christian groups who celebrate their rituals in the holy places of the Holy Land. And this book had been presented to us at lunch 2 days before by Dr. Shaul Kolbe, who is the Director of Christian Affairs for the State of Israel. He's a Jew from Trieste, a scholar, and I frankly was pleased that Western Christians had to learn about Eastern Christian rites through the scholarship of a Jew. There was something fitting about it. And I was also impressed during our visit to Israel this last week by how much Israeli Jews know about Christianity. I hadn't thought about it before. But you know, you can't live in Jerusalem. You can't live by the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or by the Garden of Gethsemane, or by the Via Dolorosa, without being curious enough to ask, what's it all about? What's the history of this place? What's the background of the gospel? What do these stones, what history do these stones tell? And whether we met people informally or on the streets or formally in meetings, we found an incredible depth of information about Christianity. I suspect that the average Israeli knows more about Christianity than the average Jew of Cleveland. And I'm convinced that the average Israeli Jew is far less defensive about this information than the average Jew of Cleveland. For here we are constantly being called upon to justify ourselves. There the Christian has to justify himself. There are 100,000 Trinitarians in all of Israel and all of the administered territories. They're the minority. They're the strange ones. They're the ones who are holding on to what seem bizarre, unexplainable myths. The majority, Muslim, Christian, are monotheists. They don't understand. And the dialogue seems to go somehow in the other direction. That night, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I saw a great piety, and I also saw a great scandal. For there was not only one church celebrating Mass, but there were two. In the same church, at the same time, not in separate chapels, not in separate rooms, but together in the same room, each trying to outshout the other. In front of the grotto of the Holy Sepulchre, the Aedicula, the Greek Orthodox were celebrating their Mass, and they occupied the main body of the church. Behind the Holy Sepulchre, there's another altar, and there the Coptic Patriarch was celebrating his Mass. And when the two processions began to approach one another, one could hear voices being raised higher and higher and higher, not so much to the greater glory of God, I suspect, as to the greater majesty of a particular denomination. And when the Greek Orthodox Patriarch made his procession three times around this grotto, it is so timed that the Coptic Patriarch takes his faithful into a little chapel just off of the main church, so there won't be a collision. And then as the Greek Orthodox service is finished, the Coptic church comes out into the main body and begins its procession, but the Copts are not allowed to go completely around the altar. They can only go halfway around. It's only that far that their property rights in this church are sustained. There have been quarrels and arguments and competition in this church about who can do what when since days immemorial. The keys to the church are kept by two Muslim families who happen to live nearby. That's the only way you can have shalom bias, any peace at all in the place. Any change which any one of these groups wants to make in the routine, the fixed routine of the holy days, the Sundays, has to get the approval of this Muslim key holder. It's fantastic. We went down to Bethlehem, to the Church of the Nativity. We saw the same thing there. In the main body of the church, the Greek Orthodox were celebrating their Mass. Just off to the left of the altar, the Armenian church was celebrating its Mass. Again, the voices raised in happy, competitive cacophony. And we were told that when the Pope had made his visit to the Holy Land some years ago, he had been able to come in through the door of the Church of Nativity as we had been able to come in, but whereas we could proceed directly down to see the grotto and so on, he had had to duck out through a side aisle, because the central nave belongs to the Greek Orthodox Church, to the side of the Church of Nativity where the Roman Catholics maintain a monastery and a church, go through Roman Catholic territory, and then come back in through the back of the church where the Roman Catholics have ingress rights to the grotto beneath. The spirit of ecumenicism has yet really to come to the Christian churches of the Holy Land. The day we went to Easter Sundays, the Coptic church and the Armenian church had gotten into fisticuffs in the courtyard of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And I'm told, I don't know this from personal witness, I'm told that in many of these holy places, the book which is memorized and known by the priests far more than the Bible is the book which describes exactly the routine and the regimen of who can do what when. There are an infinite number of Christian denominations among the Christian minority of the Holy Land. There are 100,000 Christians. I'm told that in Jerusalem, there are more patriarchs and church primates than any place else on the face of the globe except in Rome. There's the Roman Catholic Church. There's some Protestant denominations, Anglican, Lutheran, Church of Christ, Methodist. There are an infinite number of Eastern churches, Greek Orthodox, Armenian Catholic, Coptic, the Ethiopic Catholic Church, the Melkite, the Maronite, the Russian Catholic Church, the Russian Church in Exile, and on and on and on. And each of them has his own primate. Each of them has his own extraterritorial rights. And one of the happiest things that has happened to most of these churches in the Holy Land is that it is not a Christian government of some denomination or other that has authority over them. The Jews are like the Muslim keykeepers at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They grant to each church the rights which are by history theirs in a particular place. The police keep peace and break up the quarrels when they break out. The Jews can be appealed to be unbiased judges. And hopefully, a little bit of Jewishness is entering into the Christian spirit in the Holy Land. But the presence of Israel has not been an unmixed blessing for these people. Israel represents a social revolution. Israel is a welfare state. In Israel, your hospitalization, your education, your unemployment insurance, your welfare needs are taken care of by the society at large. Most of these churches came to the Holy Land historically way back when, but also to do good deeds. And the good deeds consisted largely in opening hospitals and opening orphanages and doing the things which a modern welfare state now takes care of. Some of the lack of understanding of modern Israel which exists among these churches exists precisely because Israel represents the thrust of a new kind of secularized social concern with which the traditional church has not yet come to grips. More than this, Israel represents a highly sophisticated, highly aware, highly literate society which forces upon these Christian leaders intellectual questions with which they have not had to deal with. Most of their flock are semi-literate Arabs. The leadership is alien. The Greek Orthodox leadership is all Greek. Most of the Roman Catholic hierarchy is from outside of Israel. But the parish priest and the parish itself is local. And there are, of course, very literate, very learned groups of notables who are Christians in the West Bank. But by and large, these Christian churches have number among their parishioners people who have lived in an Oriental, non-Western, in a semi-feudal, non-secular, non-welfare state society for centuries. And it's very difficult for them to adjust to the kind of outlook, to the kind of critical spirit, to the sense of history, to the questioning of traditional theology, which we take for granted, Jew and Christian, here in America, here in the West. Israel represents a tomorrow that I suspect some of these primates wished would go away. But it's interesting. It was 1 o'clock in the morning when we walked to the church. It was about 2:30 in the morning when we walked back through the church. We walked unhindered through the city streets of Jerusalem to our hotel. We saw no police. There was no need to worry about our personal safety. The day before, we had walked unhampered, unhindered, up to the Haram, up to the sacred mosque of Al-Aqsa, which is the old, which is now on the old Temple Mount, one of the sacred mosques of Islam. In Jerusalem, for the first time in several millennia, not only are the church groups and the Muslim groups, and of course the Jewish groups, allowed freedom of worship, complete control of the sacred places which are of significance to them, but there's complete freedom of ingress to these places for anyone. Israel is, you know, really at war with Jordan and with Egypt and with Syria. But almost anyone can cross the Jordan River, can fly into Lida, can disembark from a ship at Haifa, and come to the shrines and worship there. The only ones who are kept out are those who are known terrorists. Christian, Muslim, Jew has complete freedom of access to these places. And this has not existed in the Holy Land for 2,000 years. We sat one night with Dr. Moshe Davis, who is head of the Institute for Contemporary Jewish Studies at the Hebrew University. And we were talking about this phenomenon, how during the years of the Jordanian rule in Jerusalem, the Jews had been prohibited from entry to their to the old city where they had their synagogues, where there was the Wailing Wall, and how now everyone can come in. And he said, you know, it's time we Jews were given a chance. When the Christians had control of the Holy Land during the days of the Byzantine Empire, during the days of the Crusades, people were kept out. Jews, Muslims were not allowed into certain of the holy places. When the Muslims had control of the Holy Land, people were kept out. We were in Hebron. In Hebron, there is the great Machpelah, the Herodian shrine, which was sometime in the Middle Ages declared to be the cave which Abraham had bought from Sarah, and where Father Abraham and Father and Mother Sarah are presumably buried. Jew, Christian in that day, Muslim, wanted to come to this cave. But only the Muslims were allowed inside. The mosque was built there, and on the outside of the wall, they built 8 steps up to a little barred window. That was as close as any Jew, and at certain times any Christian was allowed to enter. But those steps have been torn away. Freedom of entry has been assured to all the holy places as long as it does not conflict with the sacred rites of these holy places. Moshe Davis said to us, you know, let us Jews have our time. The Muslims tried. They were unequal to the competitions, the religious rivalries here. The Christians tried. They proved unequal to the rivalries which took place here. Give us our chance. We took over Jerusalem in June of 1967. When we took over Jerusalem, everyone suddenly was allowed to enter. When we took over Jerusalem, we gave to every holy place in payment any damage which had been caused to it since 1948, whether it had been caused by our action, military action, by Jordanian military action, simply by the waste and wear of time. Give us our chance. We think that we can show you how, under a Jewish government, you can have complete control of the ingress to these places, of what happens in these places, and we can all live together in peace. And so far, what we saw indicates that the Israeli government is more than making good on this pledge. Now, we had gone to Israel in order to understand something of the complexity, something of the equities involved in the Middle East. We'd gone to see, to hear, to meet members of the Israeli government, to meet members of the Israeli intellectual community, to meet with church leaders, to visit holy places. We'd gone to see and to learn. And we had learned many things. I had learned many things. Frankly, this trip was sponsored because of our concern that the church in America has, in many ways, signaled the fact that it does not understand the basic values which are involved in the existence of Israel as a free Jewish state in this world. I've often wondered, you know, why. Tried to understand in myself, in my own mind, completely what's involved. I learned something more on this trip, and I'd like to try and share what I know, what I've learned with you. One of the problems which a Christian faces as he must face the state of Israel comes out of the folk theology of Christianity. The Jew as deicide, the Jew condemned to wander, the Jew as social outcast, the Jew as pariah, the Jew who is somehow being punished by God for that sin long ago which led to the cross. For 2,000 or 1,800 years in Europe, this kind of folk mythology has spread widely among believing Christians. And the idea of seeing Jewish vigor, Jewish energy, Jewish capacity to create a state which is strong, capable of defending itself, capable of being creative, is one which many, many churchmen find difficult. The reemergence of a Jewish vitality runs counter to one of the oldest semi-theological traditions in Christendom. But there's more than that. During 1946, 1947, 1948, you'll recall that the Vatican made great effort to secure the internationalization of Jerusalem. The Vatican was, and I think to a large degree still is, interested in having a dominant Roman Catholic religious or semi-religious, semi-political presence in Jerusalem. In those days, internationalization seemed the way. It was a much smaller United Nations. The number, the votes in the United Nations were to a large degree determined by Western Europe and Latin America, where the church had great influence. The church has not spoken recently very much about internationalization, because the church has learned that the new majority in the United Nations, the Third World, now China, Russia, the communist satellite states, do not assure her of what she wants to achieve. So we heard very little about a return to the 1947 internationalization decision. But when we met with the papal nuncio, Pierre Laghi, Monsignor Pierre Laghi, did hear again the desire for some kind of separate status for Jerusalem. I did hear again concern for what he called an energetic Catholic presence in Jerusalem. Why? I suspect because of the centrality of Jerusalem in Roman Catholic theology. It'll be difficult to attain, frankly. Roman Catholic numbers are not great in the Middle East. But the church has yet fully to recognize the existence of the State of Israel. They recognize Israel de facto, but not de jure. And there have begun a new level of discussion between the Vatican and the Israeli government, but this is relatively new. And a product, I suspect, largely of the fact that the Israelis have been so careful and circumspect in their relationships with the church. The church has a number of problems which must not be overlooked. The church has a large investment of manpower and historical energy and institutions in many Arab lands. In all of these Arab lands, the church is a minority. And the church is very much afraid that if she speaks out in a way which the Arab majorities in their jingoism and their chauvinism will find offensive, she will sacrifice these institutions and or those who are faithful to her. And then too, of course, both Roman Catholic and Western Christian parishes in the Arab world are largely Arab, though they be Christian. The parish leaders tend to be Arabs. They tend to be sometimes more Arab than the Arabs themselves, because being a minority, they have to be like some Jews in the United States, 101%. Zvi Verblosky, who's professor of comparative religions at the Hebrew University, and who's head of something which is called the Rainbow Group, a fascinating group of intellectuals and priests and ministers who meet every month or so for a discussion of interreligious affairs, informally, privately. We met with him. He told me of what he thought was the most offensive church document of the 20th century. It was a document which was published some 3 years ago when, you recall, an Australian fundamentalist set fire to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Arab mosque with the Dome of the Rock. And once this fire broke out, word immediately spread in the Arab world that the Jews were raising the Al-Aqsa Mosque because it was now the time to rebuild there the temple in Jerusalem. The 6 Christian bishops in Amman, without knowing the facts, immediately published what is tantamount to a call for a holy war. They called that Israel must be driven out of Jerusalem because it cannot be trusted to have respect for the holy places. It was a war à durance, a war to the end. There's a good bit of that still in the parishes and among the local clergy. Monsignor Laghi spoke of his own difficulties in reminding Catholic priests in the area that they were first of all Catholic, and they must speak with the word of faith, with the measure of justice, and only then Jordanians, or only then West Bankers or Syrians. But he and Bishop Appleton of the Anglican Church all confessed to us of the difficulty of holding some of these men in line and keeping them temperate, Christian, in their spirit. The Protestant Church has had traditionally other problems in the Middle East. It's a much later church, of course. It came in order to promote its missions and to do good deeds, to do good work. And it went out to work as it should have, among the poor, among the semi-literate, among those who needed medical help. And when the war broke out in 1948, the Protestant Church found that its basic relationships were not with the Jews who were taking their own fate in hand and somehow solving it, but with those who had escaped, with the refugees. These were the people they knew, and these people were now even more destitute than they had been before. And very naturally and very understandably, their hearts and souls went out to these people whose lives have been one long life of misery and burden and affliction. They never asked themselves, however, whether or not the continuance of charity to these people was an act of kindness to them. They never asked whether their own Christian spirits were not making them overlook the larger context, the reality of conditions in the Middle East. We went down to Lida Airport one night. We met 2 plane loads of Jewish refugees coming in from Vienna, Jews from Turkestan and Uzbekistan from the Soviet Union. I met a Jewish couple from Kovno, from the same little territory in Lithuania where my father had come from. We talked to these people. We talked to them of why they had left the Soviet Union, of their problems, of their concern for the rising tide of anti-Jewish activity going on there. The woman from Kovno told me that she had been a newspaper reporter until 1968 when they had made application to come to Israel, and she had been fired immediately from her job. She somehow found another job in the post office, which paid much less, but was nevertheless a job. 3 months later, they discovered that she had applied for emigration, and she was fired from there. She had then found a job as a charwoman in a little movie theater in Kovno until the time had come for them to leave. Her husband had had one arm shot away in the Second World War, in Battle of Smolensk. He was an electrical engineer. From 1968 on, he was unable to find work. They had survived somehow from hand to mouth until finally the exit permit had come. What was fascinating to us was not simply that here was human misery seeking release, seeking freedom, but that these people who had come to Israel that night, the plane had landed at 10:30, would sleep that night in the bed of the apartment which would be theirs in their new land. They were given the key to their apartment in Arad at the airport. They were told to sign a piece of paper which guaranteed them 6 months of medical insurance. They were loaned money. They were taken to the buses and taken to their new lives. As we drove back up to Jerusalem, we commented on the difference between this way of handling refugees and the squalid hovels which we'd seen in the West Bank down near Jericho. Many of you have seen them, where tens of thousands of people were kept penned up, living on the United Nations and church dole, penned up by their own brothers and sisters, not by Jews, but by Arabs, because they were useful political tools, pawns, an international game of propaganda, propaganda-based politics. Now, the Protestant Church, through its refugee activity, has been empathetic to, heart and soul involved in the missionary work in the Middle East. We went one day and we met a man named Van Goor. He's a Dutchman, lived in the Middle East for about 10 years, who's active in one of the charities which works in the Gaza Strip, sponsored by the World Council of Churches of Christ, who spoke to us very openly about all of the good work that they were doing in this area. But when we began to talk about politics, he became tongue-tied. He didn't want to speak. "I don't know," he would say. "Well, what kind of solution can you envisage?" "I have no suggestion." He was so involved in the day-to-day details that a kind of political solution seemed strange, fearful to him. He had so empathized, I found, with those whom he served. He knew their misery, had taken it unto himself, that he could not see anything but their misery. Many of these people have come back to the West and spoken honestly and openly of what they know and what they have seen. And they prefer to blame this misery not on Arab intransigence or callousness, but on the existence of the State of Israel. And when you come to talk about actual feasible political solutions to the refugee problem, they try and they don't know. The problem is larger than they are. The people have to make up their own minds. The idea that someone besides the refugees whom they deal with has a stake in the situation is a weight in the balance that they really don't want to consider. There is that. This distortion, this understandable distortion of concern. But there's more than that. This office, the World Council of Churches mission, is next door to the YMCA in what was East Jerusalem. One of the men, Reverend Pennybacker's father, had been very involved in the YMCA movement, had been a YMCA director for his life. We walked over to meet a man named Labib Nasser, who is the director of this East Jerusalem YMCA. And Reverend Pennypacker took his card and wrote our names on it and passed it in. And Labib Nasser, we found, was in but not prepared to see us. And the reason he was not prepared to see us, we discovered later on, was because I was along, a rabbi. We discovered that the Jews in Jerusalem referred to the East Jerusalem YMCA as Aelia Capitolina, which was the name the Romans gave Jerusalem in the second century when they locked its gates to all Jews. The East Jerusalem Y is a hostel, a hotel, it has some athletic facilities, exists in a Jewish state. It's run by a foreign board, but it's completely Judenrein, closed to Jews. And when the ministers went without me to meet the director of the YMCA right next to the King David Hotel, that building which so many of you have seen, where Jews come and go freely, where they comprise the bulk of the membership, and where none of them sit on the board. None of them are in any kind of committee activity. They went up to talk to this man whose father, who was put into this position 40 years ago by Reverend Pennypacker's father. And they raised this question of the Eastern Jerusalem YMCA, and this man said to them, well, a few of them tried to get in, but we showed them. There's some very good, old-fashioned, stark anti-Semitism among many of the colonialists from America and England who went out to the Middle East 20, 30, 40 years ago. They cannot understand these upstart Jews, these miserable little people from the east end of Jerusalem, from down at the tip of Manhattan, who somehow had the temerity to create a state in which now we are in a minority. And some of these people, when they come back to the United States, come back filled not only with the venom which was within them before they went, for anti-Semitism is among the most ubiquitous of diseases of the West, of Western civilization, but they now have a holy cause, the Arab. And combine anti-Semitism with pro-Arabism, and you get a great deal of misunderstanding, because these are the men whose voices are listened to in many church councils. Jews have no place in Protestant or Catholic councils. These men are turned to. They are authorities. They've lived in the area for years and years and years. I wish I could say that things were different. We seemed to be moving beyond this era of anti-Semitism and misunderstanding. I'll conclude in a few minutes by indicating that I do feel that in Israel great strides are being made, and both the church and the Israeli are moving beyond the past. But I was shocked, frankly, that the week before we left, three of the senior ministers of Washington, D.C., our capital, chose Good Friday, the day when the deicide, the crime of the Jew, is, so in front of people's minds, to preach anti-Israeli sermons. Now, anyone has a right to political positions, obviously. But why on Good Friday? What are you trying to do? Dean Sayer, the dean of Washington Cathedral, really the central Protestant church in these United States, took the occasion of his Good Friday sermon to draw in Israel from left field. He talked about man's inability to confront the good, to do what is necessary. And then somehow, as the one example, it was a very short sermon, as the one example of man's evil, he took the Jew, Israel, Jerusalem. He accused the Israelis of mass deportations. He accused the Israelis of mass expropriation. He accused the Israelis of having been contemptuous of all that is sacred. And he concluded with these words, which seemed to me out of some kind of medieval past. Now the Jews have it all. But even as they praise their God for the smile of fortune, to begin almost simultaneously to put him to death. As I read these words, I confess that I reminded myself of many an Episcopal bull, church bull of the Middle Ages, which prevented the Jew from appearing on the streets of Frankfurt or Bremen or Kovna between Good Friday and Easter, as because their appearance on the street on those days would be an affront to any good Christian. Somehow we were, again, in the 20th century, guilty of the crime of deicide. Now these speeches, which were carefully orchestrated and carefully leaked to the newspapers, were decried by many, Catholic, Protestant. The head of the Council of Churches in Greater Washington called it provocative rhetoric, the kind of rhetoric which should have been left, he had felt we should long since have outgrown. But it's still there. still there. And as we discovered during this visit to the Middle East, churchmen who are concerned with justice and equity and the Christian spirit are going to have to be very careful in their councils when they come to discuss the problems of the Middle East or any problem dealing with Jews, to know the credentials of the man that they're listening to look into his heart as well as into his words. That's the past, but it's still the present. But there's a present which is also, I hope, the future. We met in Jerusalem the Anglican bishop, Bishop Abbott. I've rarely met a man of, I guess he was in his late 60s, of such spirit and vigor and energy. He'd come to Jerusalem 3 years before. He replaced a man who could talk about Jews only with thin lips. But this man has gone the length and breadth of the country, learning, reading, understanding, talking. He's the senior bishop of essentially an Arab Episcopal church, but he speaks with the voice of equity and justice and Christianity. He spoke of the sins of Israel. Israel has sins on her conscience. He spoke of the problems and the sins of the church. I've concentrated on those today. He spoke with a voice which was balanced, moderate, and just. Wherever we went in with Israelis, we were told, yes, there are new voices. Who? Men like Bishop Appleton. Yes, there are new voices. Who? Well, there's the papal nuncio, Pierre Laghi, whom you met. You know that the last papal nuncio in Jerusalem, when he wrote to the Israeli government, would never address anyone by name. It was always to whom it may concern. This man, he went to Seder last year with Moshe Davis. He has Jewish friends. He's alive to the new reality. They're talking together. And they're finding that the Israeli, in many cases, are far more aware and learned and sensitive to Christian history and Christian spirit than they had any knowledge. There is this Rainbow group with whom we met. There are other groups like it, ecumenical institutes here and there in the land. For the first time in the last 2 or 3 years, there are people who are meeting, and there are people who are talking, and the talk is not just preaching at each other. But they're still the very, very few. And all of us left Israel with the hope that those churches of the West who send men to Israel will send men who are of open spirit. And I left Israel pleased with the openness of the spirit of the Israelis whom we had met, hoping that conditions would continue to be good and allow the Israelis to meet their Christian compatriots more than halfway. I left Israel encouraged. The economy is booming. The city of Jerusalem is knitting together. As you drive through the West Bank after the elections, you sense the possibility of some kind of peaceful evolution of a federation. As you talk to Israelis and Arabs, they're talking of possibilities. It's no longer, you know, blank wall facing blank wall. I suspect that if Jordan and the West Bank and Israel were allowed to work out the problems in the Middle East, they would be worked out. Everyone spoke to us with fear of Egypt, of Russia. That's the great unknown. But if the parties immediately involved are given some breathing room, some time, Arab, Christian, Jew seem to indicate great hope, a great possibility. There are new kinds of men rising in the Middle East, men who know each other, who have been raised in the same conditions, who come not from the West, but from the land itself, who have lived cheek by jowl with each other during their childhood, during their adolescence, who have even gone to school with one another, who know each other as human beings. And so there is now conversation and dialogue, as well as pronouncement and denunciation. But it's all all very tentative. It's all just the beginning. It's going to take time. It's going to have to be opportunity. As we sat around a room in the basement assembly room of the Hebrew Union College, my bishops and I and this rainbow group of priests, ministers, scholars, Israelis, we talked. One of them said, you know, Jerusalem is called the city of peace, but it may be the last place in the world, the last place in the world where the great religious bodies will finally come together. And someone else, the Israeli, said, no, not necessarily so. We've come a long way when all is considered. Give us a chance. Let's work together. We have to work things out here. We have an old Israeli expression, Ein Brera. There's no alternative. If in the city of peace, sacred to the three great faiths of the world, we can't, as religious people, work out a modus vivendi, work out each other's dignity and rights, how can we expect anything of the world at large? We have to set the example here. Ki mitzion tetzei Torah, or from Zion, goeth forth the example. Perhaps it will be so. We walked through the streets of Jerusalem, talking about the problems of that faraway place. We walked through the streets of Jerusalem, talking about our own problems in this very near space. After all, the four of us are going to have more to say about what happens here in Cleveland than we are about what happens in Jerusalem. But as we walked through the streets, talking about there and here, about the many problems of our very confused world, we were talking. We had become friends. And in that fact, the possibility of friendship, common purpose, I think there's some real hope. Amen.